Welcome to Reflections and Wonders, revisiting Mark's Gospel, a podcast that's just me wondering off the top of my head about Mark's Gospel for the second time in 3 years. My name is Norm Seeley, and I'm a minister at Jubilee United Church in Toronto, Canada. I've been a minister for over 30 years, and every year my thoughts and wonderings change. So, Monday to Friday, I'll be reading my way through Mark, even though I read through Mark in 2020. The world has changed. I've changed, and so I expect my wonderings will have changed as well. I don't have notes, and I haven't checked back to see what I said 3 years ago, but I am looking forward to hearing what I say now. Or more importantly, what I think God may be saying now. I want to thank Drew Winters for the music and you for joining me as we wonder about the earliest gospel. Yeah, it was written before Matthew, Luke, or John. I will do my best to keep my wonderings between 18 and 30 minutes, but every once in a while we may go a couple of minutes long. You should know that this is an audio version of a video blog that I recorded 2 weeks ago. So if you want to see what I look like when I'm wondering, well, you can find me on my YouTube channel. Search Norm Seeley, N-O-R-M-S-E-L-I. Or even easier, find me at the Jubilee United Church website, www.jubileeunited.ca. And if you want to support this and other digital ministries of Jubilee United Church, you can make a donation through canadahelps.org. We are Jubilee United Church in Ontario. So, let's see what Mark's Gospel has to say this time. Today we're Mark chapter 14, verses 43 to 52. Yesterday, you may recall that Jesus prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane while the disciples all fell asleep, even after being asked to stay awake. So we've had the Last Supper. Everyone's told they're going to desert Jesus. Jesus has gone to Gethsemane to pray. They have fallen asleep. And then this is what happens. Mark 14, 43 to 52. Immediately, while he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, arrived, and with him there was a crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders. Now the betrayer had given them a sign, saying, "The one I will kiss is the man. Arrest him and lead him away under guard." So when he came and went up to him at once and said, "Rabbi," and kissed him. Then they laid hands on him and arrested him. But one of those who stood near drew his sword and struck the slave of the high priest, cutting off his ear. And Jesus said to them, "Have you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me as though I were a bandit? Day after day I was with you in the temple teaching, and you did not arrest me. But let the scriptures be fulfilled. All of them deserted and fled." A certain young man was following him, wearing nothing but a linen cloth. They caught hold of him, but he left the linen cloth and ran off naked. Stop there. Again, familiar perhaps to most of us. And as I'm reading it, as I'm hearing it, I see the scenario the way it's usually put together. It's been taught this way to me when I was a kid. It's been preached to this way. I've heard it as an adult. I've seen it in movies, and you know, it's fairly straightforward. Jesus is there, he's prayed, asking, you know, God, if there's another way to do all this, but accepting that there isn't. And while he's talking with the disciples about staying awake, in the middle of that, Judas arrives with a whole bunch of soldiers, all sent by the temple authorities, the temple police. We've heard about them in previous stories, the ones who were sent to arrest Jesus, but just couldn't find a way to do it, just felt compelled to not do that. You may recall that in John's Gospel. So they've come to arrest him, and Judas has told him, "Give them the sign. I'm going to kiss that one. The one I kiss, arrest him, lead him away." And so we hear about how Judas's betrayal is so personal and so intimate. He doesn't just sort of point and go, there, that's the guy, get him. He really gets up close and kisses him, and Jesus lets him kiss him. And that just heightens the level of betrayal that Jesus must have felt, and shows us how Judas just doesn't get it at all. That Judas is a horrible person, betraying Jesus with a kiss. Yep, okay. And I get that. And then Peter, who was passionate about Jesus and said he would never desert him, he jumps up and cuts off the ear of one of the soldiers. One of the ones who came, it's the slave of the high priest, so the one who works for the high priest. Now, it doesn't say Peter here. John tells the same story and tells us it's Peter who cuts off the ear. Mark says it was one of them. I don't know whether, I mean, if it was Peter, I would think Mark would have said that, but I can see John wanting to add that detail to Mark's story. Just makes it a little more interesting. But whether it's Mark or isn't Mark, doesn't matter. One of Jesus' disciples gets up and in his passion tries to cut off one of the soldiers. Cuts off his ear. And Jesus steps in immediately and addresses those who've come to arrest him. Have you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me as though I were a bandit? Day after day I was with you in the temple teaching, but you did not arrest me. I mean, Jesus is calling to attention the fact that they're arresting him where nobody can see. They're arresting him without the crowd around. They're arresting him secretly. How shameful is that? He's been at the temple all the time. He hasn't been trying to avoid them. They are trying to avoid the scrutiny. That's highlighted by what Jesus says. It's highlighted by Jesus' words, perhaps for those who are arresting him. Because if John got it right, most of them don't really want to. They kind of get that they're supposed to, but they don't really want to because he doesn't seem like such a bad guy. And then when you listen to him, there's this feeling and this sense. And Jesus is pointing that out to them. But he's also not putting up any fight at all. Jesus is good. The ones who arrest him are bad. The disciples are passionate but foolish, and Judas is horrible. And there we go. Okay. I mean, I can listen to that story, I can read into that story, I can wonder about that story and wonder, would I be one of the soldiers doing my job? Would I be affected by Jesus pointing out that we're arresting him in secret? Might I decide I don't want to be part of this? I might wonder whether I'm one of the disciples, the guy who would jump up and grab a sword and cut somebody's ear off in an effort to protect Jesus. I might wonder, am I that? I might wonder if I'm Judas, who betrays intimately. I might wonder about all those things. I might wonder if I might learn something by thinking myself as Jesus, who accepts what is going to happen. Yeah, maybe all those things. But my problem is something about it just doesn't feel quite right. As Jesus says to them, I've been in the temple every day. You could have arrested me. Well, yeah, Jesus has been in the temple every day. People have seen him. The crowds have gathered. So you're telling me that these people who came with Judas, they didn't know which one Jesus was? They don't recognize him? Surely you'd recognize him from the temple. Surely the fact that the other ones are sort of around him and listening to him, maybe they aren't sitting around in a circle listening to him, but, you know, if you go into a group of 12 people, one's the boss and the other, and then 11 are followers, you can tell pretty quickly which one the boss is. And you can probably tell who Jesus is. Surely some of them have seen him. Judas could have stood at a distance and pointed and said, yeah, he's over there. Why does Judas go up and kiss him? Why does Judas have to identify him at all? Well, I'm going to go back to my pet theory. Not because I'm trying to push it as truth, but because it's part of my wondering, and I just like to sort of look from the other side. So Judas and Jesus have planned this in the same way that Jesus had planned for a room to be available for them for the Passover, same way that Jesus planned for a donkey to be available for the ride into Jerusalem. Jesus has planned this whole thing out very carefully, and Judas is part of that plan. So Judas is going to bring the soldiers. They're going to follow him, even though they know who he is. And Judas gets up close to Jesus to kiss him. This is quiet, peaceful, and non-violent. If Judas stood at a distance and pointed, yeah, it's the guy over there, then they all come in, and basically they're going to grab the 12 people who are there. They're going to grab all of them, because if we don't know who Jesus is, because we're worried about maybe there's going to be a fight, Jesus is going to try to get away, no, we'll just grab all of them. So there is the potential for a battle. There's the potential for people being hurt. All sorts of things. It's violent. But Judas comes right up, calls him rabbi, and kisses him. Rabbi is a term of respect. Is this Judas respecting Jesus? Is this Judas doing his job? And he kisses Jesus, because it's really hard to stab somebody who's just been kissed. It's really hard for it to get all out of hand when there's been a kiss. If he'd gone and poked him, that's a thing. If he'd stood at a distance and pointed at him, all of those have potential for violence. To me, this has the least potential for violence. Judas brings them to a quiet place where there's no crowds. The crowds can't be hurt. Okay, no innocent bystanders. He goes right into the group and kisses Jesus, just de-escalating everything. Of course, it's the well-meaning disciple who's going to escalate things. Jump up with a sword and swing a sword at a soldier or the slave to the high priest, the one who assists the high priest. Wow. I'm not going to turn this into, oh my God, there you go once again, this church has messed everything up. It's the followers of Jesus that make everything go bad. That's not what I think this is saying. But it is an invitation for me to wonder how often, as a person of faith, in a moment of high tension, in a moment of crisis, in a moment of worry and concern, do I fall back on the ways of the world? The way of the world is to get your sword and fight. The way of Jesus is to do what Jesus did, which is not to put up a fight. Not a violent fight. To point out to them what they are doing that they might all understand. You come to me, I've been at the temple every day and you never come. But you come now. That's the way Jesus fights, by inviting them to think about what it is they're doing, for them to examine their conscience, for them to reflect on their actions. That's the way Jesus is going to fight, not by overpowering them. It's funny, I haven't heard the term in a while, but you know, it's so much a part of our culture. This myth of redemptive violence, it's so appealing. This idea that a good bully can beat up a bad bully, and it makes things okay. And I'm going way back to the movie I grew up on. Movies like My Bodyguard, Chris Makepeace. Never happened to Chris. Anyway, I Jack Reacher stories, if you read those books or watch that Amazon series. Every Clint Eastwood movie, frankly. You know, there's a good bully who stands up to the bad bullies. And God, thank goodness, the bad guys finally get beaten up by somebody who's tougher, stronger, meaner. But he's tougher, stronger, mean on our side. So it's, yes, it's okay. So we get this idea that that's going to make everything all right. So if somebody's out to hurt you, the way you can fix it is to get somebody stronger to hurt them. Now, when you just sit alone or talk to a friend about whether or not that really works, I think you come to a conclusion fairly quickly that no, it doesn't. And there'll always be somebody say, oh yeah, no, well, sometimes that's what you need. You need to stand up to the bully. Stand up and just Bop them in the nose. That's the only thing they understand. My experience is when you stand up to the bully and bop him in the nose, the bully goes and gets a couple of friends and then comes back. Because the bully will never forget the humiliation of being bopped in the nose. That's my experience. More often than not, the bully comes back with a new weapon, a new ally, a stick, a gun. People hate to lose. They hate to be defeated. Nobody likes to be bullied, especially bullies. Now, I'm not saying that if a bully is beating you up, the best thing to do is just hug it out. Just put your arms around him and hold on until he loves you. I get that. It doesn't work either. I'm one of those who probably tends for what I like to think is a middle path, which is where I'll puff up a little bit and stand my ground and go, you really want to get into this? That's really what we're going to do? Because this is going to be hard for us both. Which makes it sound like I'm being less of a bully. I'm just inviting them to reflect on the fact that they're going to hit me, I'm going to hit them, and we're both going to end up bruised. And maybe I'll win, maybe I won't, but it's going to hurt us both. So let's not do it. So I tell myself that that's the middle path. But it's not. It's not. If Jesus wanted to take that middle path, he'd have looked at these people sent to arrest him and said, look, you're going to arrest me. The word's going to get out to the crowd. The crowd's going to get upset. There's going to be a riot. And then Rome's going to get involved, and you people are going to lose power. And in the end, everyone's going to be hurt. I might get killed, but you guys are going to be so sad. He doesn't do that. He doesn't take that middle path. He simply says, seriously, you're coming to arrest me? Why? Why here? Why now? You could have picked me up anytime. Anytime. He's inviting them to reflect on what it is they're doing, and he is hoping they may make a better choice. I don't know if that's what Mark wants me to wonder about, but that's what I wonder about when I hear this. How it is that we, as people of faith, how is it that I, as a Christian, a follower of Jesus, I do want to leap up and I do want to fight them off with that sword, and I may die, but I'll die for Jesus. The myth of redemptive violence. Somehow I can be violent and make things better. And I don't have to ask for world data. I don't have to debate it. From my own experience, it rarely works. And if I really examined it closely, I might discover, using a broad, long lens, it never works. I don't know that. I can't swear that it never works. I don't have the lens for it. But I wonder. And this story invites me to wonder about it. Well-meaning people, when panicked, go the way of the world. I mean, they're disciples of Jesus. They're one of the 12, these people who are with Jesus, right? Jesus didn't have a crowd of 70 people with him. Jesus has 11 followers because Judas was the 12th. So there's Jesus and 11. There's 12 of them that are all together. So these are Jesus' tight crew. These are real absolute believers. If John's got it right and this is Peter, we've seen the transfiguration. We've walked on water. We've done so many things with Jesus. And in this moment of crisis, instead of doing what Jesus would do, in fact, just shut up and watch what Jesus does, he jumps in and does what the world does. So even if I'm not talking about the myth of redemptive violence, you don't have to buy into that if you don't want to. That's fine. But there's an opportunity here to wonder, how often do we abandon the church way, the God way, the Jesus way? How often do we abandon that for the world's way? Because the world's way, in a moment of crisis, just seems to solve the problem a lot faster. Or it feels better. Because that's the other thing. I mean, I might look at that in a moment if I had all the wisdom I could have and go, well, okay, wait a minute. So if I stand up, maybe we do win this battle, and then maybe Jesus doesn't have to die, and then maybe it's going to be better for Jesus, and this will all work out. Maybe that's what I'm thinking. But Jesus already said this is what has to happen, and this is what is going to happen. So what I'm doing will have no actual effect on the outcome. If I really do trust Jesus, then picking up a sword to fight these guys off will have no effect on the outcome. But it might make me feel better in the moment. I'm sitting here feeling impotent and afraid, so I'm just going to swing out and hurt somebody. Maybe the lesson is, when I am impotent and afraid, maybe I should follow Jesus. Not worry about making myself feel better by swinging out at somebody, but just following Jesus. Let the scriptures be fulfilled, Jesus says. He doesn't put up a fight at all. They came to do a job. The faithful had a thing they could have done, but they abandoned it because when it gets tough, I have to remind myself of that. When things are easy, it's easy to hang on to my faith. When things get tough, oh boy, good smack. That would sort things out, wouldn't it? The other thing that sort of I wonder about at the very end there, a certain young man was following him wearing nothing but a linen cloth. They caught hold of him, but he left the linen cloth and ran off naked. I have always been told that's Mark, the one who wrote the gospel. This is Mark's way of saying I was there. Could be. Paul seems to think so. I'm trying to think, wow, what letter it's in. Paul would indicates that the upper room, the room where they had the Passover, was Mark's house, or Mark's mother's house. Right? So perhaps the gospel writer's mother was a follower of Jesus. Perhaps it was in his childhood home where the supper happened, and when the supper happened, they left, and maybe he followed them out of curiosity. It's been suggested to me that, in fact, Judas came back with the soldiers and first went to the house where Jesus had been, and when realized Jesus wasn't there anymore, figured, Jesus is gone, probably to Gethsemane, and so he's headed off there, and then young Mark, running around his house naked, apparently, quickly grabs, a linen cloth to throw on so that he can run there ahead and hopefully warn Jesus, but doesn't get there in time. It's a great story. Sure, why not? Maybe you could tell yourself he followed them and in fact was hiding in the trees and did hear Jesus praying. As I was reflecting yesterday, who heard Jesus? How do we know what Jesus said in his prayers? Well, maybe this is Mark's way of saying, yeah, I was in the bushes. I heard the whole thing. That's why, and I remember it very well. It ties it up really nicely. I get it. So this gospel is written, most would suggest to you, suggest to us that between the year 60 and 70, CE, Common Era, or AD, Anno Domini, or whatever you want to call it, we'll go to the year 70. Because it's in existence shortly after the year 70, right? So seemed to be that decade before it would be written, 60 to 70, in around there. Well, that's 30 and 40 years after the events have taken place. What took them so long to write it? I don't know. Maybe they didn't need it. Maybe Mark and his mother, his family, they were all part of a Christian community, followers of Jesus. They shared their stories. They knew their stories. And Mark's getting older, and Mark can no longer tell the stories of what he remembers and what he saw. And so now he's writing them down so that we have a gospel. That makes perfect sense. I have no problem with that. And it also allows me to say, well, maybe the prayers are real, because maybe Mark did hear them. Could be. Not quite sure why we had to hear about him running off naked, but it all kind of fits together. But the thing is, the text doesn't say it. We're just doing our best. The people who came before me and my colleagues, they wonder about this, and that's where their wondering took them. They wondered and said, yeah, what if it is? And all those pieces fit together for them. And that's great. And that's good wondering. I have no issue with that. But I also can look at this and wonder about it again and go, hey, what if it isn't Mark? Because there's no reason to believe it is Mark other than it kind of fits. If it's not Mark, Why does Mark tell that story? A certain young man. So it's a specific person, so I guess I'm not meant to think of him metaphorically. He's not, you know, a literary device or an image. Wearing nothing but a linen cloth. He's not a soldier. I don't know why. I guess the idea is maybe he's just young. Maybe this is about being vulnerable. And then we hear why he wasn't caught. Of course, I don't know why they needed to arrest him. A certain young man was following him, wearing nothing but a linen cloth. They caught hold of him, but he left the linen cloth and ran off naked. Well, they weren't arresting the rest of the people. So why would they be arresting him? Unless, like the others who wondered before, this is young Mark, and Jesus just had dinner at his house, and he ran ahead to warn Jesus that the soldiers were coming. They may be, yep, so he's aiding and abetting a criminal. Maybe. Or maybe this is something to think about. And it's vulnerable. It's frightening. So maybe this is metaphor. When he says certain, it makes me think it's not metaphor. But maybe this is metaphor. And we're supposed to understand that this is a vulnerable story we're hearing here. And it may be he runs off like all the others do. Because they took his linen cloth. They took what he had to cover himself. They took what he had. It's been stripped away. And in this moment, because the followers of Jesus, the disciples, because their faith was so bound in the way the world goes, and that myth of redemptive violence, we should stand up and have a fight, Jesus doesn't put up a fight at all, and it's like everything's been ripped away from them. They also, in this moment, feeling very vulnerable and very naked, and so they run off like him. I don't know. It's an interesting little detail. And I think probably, if forced to pick what I think is most likely true, I'm okay with Mark suggesting, with Mark including himself in the story here, just as a little nod, to kind of go like, yeah, I was there. I'm the one who ran off naked, because who else would know? I'm okay with that. The thing is, it doesn't have to be that, and we're allowed to wonder. Anyway, with all that, I'm going to stop now. Offer you a prayer and leave you to wonder. So, let us pray. Loving God, we thank you for this time of wondering. We thank you for the faith of the disciples, and we understand the fears. We thank you for the power of the stories and the example they set. We recognize ourselves in their story, and we, God, try to learn. And we, God, try to hear your voice and know, follow your will. God, we ask that our wondering today be a time when we have heard your voice, a time when we have grown in faith and grown closer to you. We pray in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ, through the Holy Spirit. Amen. So that's it for me today, but I look forward to seeing you tomorrow, and maybe tomorrow we'll finally wrap up chapter 14. Here's hoping. Anyway, until I get to see you, God bless you. Please know that God sees you and knows you and loves you. More than that, God's love moves through you out into the world in incredible ways. You matter. You make a difference more than you'll ever know. We'll see you tomorrow. God bless.